are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, May 29th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, the Trump administration starts separating families at the border. North Koreans coming to the U.S. in pre-summit talks. Yeah. It's off, then it's on, then it maybe is on. New Harvard study, almost 5,000 more deaths in Puerto Rico than our government claims. Also, the 1,500 so-called missing immigrant kids clarified. SCOTUS attacks abortion rights by doing nothing. And is it the left versus the resistance? White House announces tariffs on China shortly after a story that Trump's ZTE help offer comes after Ivanka's company got some big Chinese deals. Corporations using their tax breaks for buybacks now predict no raises or new jobs. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, happy. Well, sort of feels like Monday because we had no Monday. We did have Monday. Of course, it was Memorial Day. Hope you had an enjoyable day doing whatever you were doing. Hope you did give a moment to contemplate the hundreds of thousands of people who have who gave their lives for a, in many instances, very dubious reasons. But did so sincerely and obviously to not just great pains to themselves, but to their families. Definitely worth taking a moment to mourn that, even if we can have a different opinion as to whether or not our civilian leadership should be engaging in such activities. I am somewhat fried. As it is, we had a full bat mitzvah weekend. That's right.
Jew time.
Saturday afternoon, I stood at, in the atop Grand Army Plaza. I climbed up and blew the shofar. That's not true. My daughter...
That we should have filmed.
That, yes, that would have been the YouTube hit of the century. My daughter was a bat mitzvah this weekend, and it was a, and because it was Memorial Day weekend, and basically what happened is, we were, my former wife and I were, we're a little bit slow on the uptake, and so by the time we were in a position to choose which weekend we could. Could have my daughter bat mitzvah, it was either Memorial Day weekend or Labor Day weekend. Everybody had taken all the other weekends. And our big fear was, I didn't want Labor Day weekend because I didn't want her like having that hang over her over the summer. And my big fear was that nobody would show up because it's Memorial Day weekend. You know, a lot of people have plans that they've made long time out, but we didn't have a huge bat mitzvah because the best way to see Aerosmith is in a crowd of like 60 or less. And so when we had the Aerosmith and the boys come in to play, wanted it to be, But do you remember that? There was a bar mitzvah where Al Smith played. Like during, it was like a guy was a gun runner or something during the Iraq War.
Man. I think I did hear about
Sean
that.
Sean recently worked production at a bar mitzvah where they had Fetty Wap.
That's cool.
I have no idea what
that was. The Nicki Minaj one looked awesome too.
Well, we had none of those things. But we had a very nice luncheon, and then my daughter had a kids party that was Sunday night, and that was an interesting experience to be in a room with that many 13-year-olds. Nobody got busted, as far as I could tell. Nobody was drinking or doing drugs, which is an upgrade from my bat mitzvah party. Bar mitzvah party.
Your bat mitzvah?
Bar. But
say it again, Samantha.
Lot of family, so it was a little bit exhausting. But I'm back now.
I'm doing the same thing next weekend with my family.
Are you serious?
Not my kid, obviously. Oh. I don't have any kids, but my cousin's kid.
Well, yeah, it's an experience. Believe me, enjoy the 13-year-olds. But I will say this.
I will.
I did get compliments for cleaning up well from my relatives, because they usually see me. I'm not quite as clean shaven. What was my secret? Well, Harry's knows that a great shave comes down to great blades. Made with sharp, durable steel that lasts. That's why they make some of the highest quality blades in the world. And for those of us who are price sensitive about all of our purchases, they are priced much lower than the leading brand. They'll even give you a full refund if you don't love your shave, as long as you let them know within 30 days. And you know what? If it's going to take you more than 30 days to remember a bad shave, guess what? You're going to forget about it. It's not happening. For me, I remember all my shaves like within 3 or 4 days, and then I forget them. Harry's stands behind the quality of their blades, so they created a $13 trial set that comes with everything you need for a close, comfortable shave. The weighted ergonomic handle, the 5-blade razor with a lubricating strip and a trimmer blade for those of us who have misshapen nostrils. That's my thing. That's my hook. Rich lathering shave gel, a travel blade cover. Claim yours by going to harrys.com/majority report. Folks, you know what I love about Harry's. I love the lack of an expensive razor. I love the fact they send it to me. And I got to say, like, as you get older, you get a little bit more conscious of like, hey, that ergonomic razor, that makes me feel good about myself in the morning. It's a nice looking razor. Yeah, believe me, when you get to be my age, it's the little things that really wrap it up for you. My listeners
don't
can
say
redeem
wrap it up just yet. Don't
yeah,
be that
I mean it's just you know okay. I'm coasting now. I've had one kid bat mitzvah. Now I'm just coasting
better.
Into the next one.
That sounds better.
Our listeners can redeem their trial set at harrys.com/majority report. You go to harrys.com/majority report, all one word. To redeem your offer, let them know I sent you to help support the show. Also, and this is actually working out. I mean, I don't know if they want to be associated with a separation, but Blue Apron has been a staple of our menu at the Cedar household for, what is it, like 2 years now? I don't know, 3 years ago. I was a customer before they were a sponsor of the show. And when it comes to dinner, Blue Apron can take care of all the planning, all the shopping. Fresh, pre-proportioned ingredients, chef-designed step-by-step recipes, Blue Apron lets you see what food can be and do. Enjoy delicious meals like popcorn chicken. We had that recently. Sweet chili cabbage slaw and cumin spice wonton noodles with vegetables and peanuts. The kids actually loved that. The idea that like I could say like cumin and they would eat something would be great. You get 12 new recipes, all designed by Blue Apron's in-house culinary team, and change based upon what's on season each week. You can pick 2, 3, or 4 recipes based on what best fits your schedule. We have been consistently a 2-night-a-week family. And frankly, since Nikki and I got separated, it's been it's been even a greater blessing. We may go to three nights a week because you don't have to worry about shopping. You're still cooking a really nice home-cooked meal. In fact, a significantly better meal than either one of us would come up on our own because, you know, who thinks of these things? Got to be a chef. And it makes it super easy. Best of all, Blue Apron is offering our listeners their first three meals free. I don't know why every one of you guys in this office are not doing it. I don't know if you've taken advantage of it or not yet, but you should.
I eat rice and beans from the bodega most of the time.
Well, time to up your game. At least get the three meals for free. They're delicious meals. And like I say, you can schedule them over the course of a week or two. Sometimes we keep them in the fridge with all the ingredients for like 4 or 5 days. Then we cook it up. Check out this week's menu. Get your first three meals free at blueapron.com/majority. blueapron.com/majority. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. All right, before we get to the next thing, and I want to get to the immigration stuff, but first, this was really touching. Look, I grew up in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Oh, right.
And for years and years, it was always wait till next year. And it was, you know, Bernie Cabo, he hits the home run, but it doesn't matter. Fisk, look, he waves it. They always play that, you know, video because it's cool, but they didn't win. They had not won a championship until 04. And, of course, in 04, it was right during the Bush-Kerry election, and I was on the radio 7 to 10 every night, or 6 to 9, and so I missed a lot of the games.
Too.
Huh?
I didn't know you had a night shift, too.
Oh, yeah, that's the cool. First majority report. So I didn't see the Sox win there. But I grew up watching the Sox. Sometimes I'd come down to New York when I was in college. I'd come down to New York and go into the bleachers and get into, not fist fights, but pretty close with the Yankees fans. But this weekend, I had a moment where I thought, maybe I could become a Yankees fan. And why was that? Was it because Judge had a play that blew me away or he hit four home runs? Or no. No, it wasn't. It was because of this. Did you hear that? It was a happy birthday to Rudy Giuliani, and then you hear this cascade of boos. Gotta love it.
Screw you, buddy.
Gotta love it. I don't know that he would have gotten that many boos if he wasn't Donald Trump's flack, but... it's nice to think that he would, either way, because he deserves him. He really does deserve him.
Yeah, he does.
For a myriad of reasons.
New Yorkers hate him.
You know, people forget that Rudy Giuliani, prior to 9/11, was wildly unpopular in New York City. New York City was sick of this dude. And 9/11 boosted his career, not unlike George W. Bush's. So...
more nationally than locally, though, don't you think?
I think so, to a certain extent. I think there was also like just enough of a shock in the city where it was just like, yes, there was no, people didn't have, I think probably in the city it went up, but I think it was probably diminished quicker than it did nationally. And nationally, look, it was very much associated with 9/11 and very narrow. Every time he would go to run for president, by the time he got to New Hampshire, the first primary, I remember, I think it was in 2008, I was up in New Hampshire, and I went to a Rudy Giuliani rally or speech, and it was, I had to rewrite the entire bit because there was literally no one there, and it was just incredibly sullen. Hey, folks, since you're listening to this podcast, you probably love learning on the go. And with Blinkist, you become better informed in less time than you thought possible. The Blinkist app transforms over 2,000 of the best-selling nonfiction books into powerful packs you can read or listen in just 15 minutes. These are like the cliff notes, the audio cliff notes. Get key insights from 2 to 3 books covering topics like productivity, business, and self-improvement on your way home. Their team of experts is constantly adding new titles, so you're always getting the most powerful ideas. No wonder Forbes, BuzzFeed, New York Times are all talking about Blinkist. Feast your mind on key ideas from top-selling fiction books like Tool of Titans, that Tim Ferriss. I don't listen to his podcast as much as I used
to. You were really into that podcast.
For a long time, yeah. I was. I don't know what happened to that. But Tools of Titans is like where he distills, you know, he does the habits of successful people, not just in business, but in anything. And Tools of Titans is sort of like a compilation of that. There's that The Subtle Art of Not Giving an F.
Great title.
That's available on that one. What They Don't Teach You at Harvard Business School. I mean, part of this is like I don't know anything about business, and I'm sort of fascinated by having a business mentality. So I listen to these things. It's part anthropological, but it's also part for me, like, I feel like I should know this.
I'm not a businessman. I am a businessman.
That's correct. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer for just the Majority Report listeners. Go to Blinkist.com/majority. Right now, start your free trial or get 3 months off your yearly plan when you join today. That's Blinkist, B-L-I-N-K. IST, Blinkist.com/majority. Start your free trial or get 3 months off your yearly plan. Blinkist.com/majority. All right, let's get into what's going on with the immigration policies, because this has gotten a lot of play. And I'm not exactly sure what has driven it. I think there was like National Missing Children's Week last week. And 2 weeks ago, we had just headlined that story that a division of Department of Homeland Security had lost track of 1,500 kids. Now, these were unaccompanied minors. And at that time, unaccompanied minors were literally minors who came to the border unaccompanied. And because the Trump administration, it's my understanding, is now deeming minors who come to this to the border with their parents and taking them as unaccompanied. But at that time, these are children who parents may have said, I don't have the money to go with you. I'm sending you with, a smuggler, or they go up by themselves to escape harsh conditions on where they live. Sometimes, massively dangerous, sometimes without any opportunities to advance, whatnot. So when they get to the border, the Office of Refugee Resettlement matches them up more often than not with relatives who are in the country. Mostly legal, I believe the relatives are. That's the way that they would have them. It's conceivable some went into foster care, but this is mostly relatives. Some end up getting trafficked in some way. But the Office of Refugee Resettlement does not keep, well, it keeps records on where they placed them, but they did not do anything diligent to find these people. They're not tracking them, which is probably a good thing. Particularly in this day and age. One of the reasons why people, the hard sell for DACA, where you hear about there are X number of DACA folks, but then there's an extra couple hundred thousand, 400,000 who are eligible and have not signed up, is because people were very nervous about signing up for a government program. Because even if they felt that the Obama administration had best of intentions, you know, there's always that one in, like, let's say 10 chances that the next president is going to be Donald Trump, and they're going to start using that as a means in which to round you up. So it's probably good that the government does not keep intense track of these unaccompanied minors. Although, there's a downside to that too. People get trafficked. You're placing people with relatives. You don't know. I don't know how much vetting goes on in these situations. Here is a report from PBS Frontline that talks about teenagers from Guatemala who are trafficked as workers at an egg farm. And it's pretty upsetting.
It's really modern day slavery. In the United States of America, there's no such thing as a job that you're not allowed to quit. The kids in this case came from, and there's an adult victim or two also, came from Guatemala.
All right, pause it for 1 second. The guy speaking is an attorney general of Ohio, and this is a 2014 case. These teenagers came up from Guatemala, ostensibly to, listen to them.
And there's an adult victim or two also, came from Guatemala. What happened was they were transported up to the United States, and when they get here, they're promised that they're going to attend school, that these children are going to have the promise of America. Instead, they get here, and they're put in the trailer park in horrible conditions.
Well, when we walked in, it smelled like feces and just pure pee.
Okay, pause it. So here you have a situation where several of these teens were released to people claiming to be relatives or friends, and they turned out to be labor traffickers. I mean, this is part of the problem. And on one hand, you want the Office of Refugee Resettlement to vet the people that they're giving it. They're basically putting these kids in their care. On the other hand, you know, do you really want the Office of Refugee and Resettlement to know anything about these people because of the circumstances we're in? I mean, the bottom line is there's no good answer to that question until we have some type of actual policies that recognize immigrants, whether they are documented or not, are human beings. And there is no collective punishment that we can exercise that is going to keep people in countries that are unsafe for them.
They're forced to work, 6-7 day weeks for many, many hours a day, doing things like debeaking chickens, doing the kind of work that is difficult work. When it comes time for the paychecks to come out, somebody else, one of their recruiters, gets it. When one victim had the gall to ask for their paycheck, something that people here take for granted, he got hit. He gets literally hit by the master.
Over here in the right-hand corner, there's bed mattresses. There was kids' shoes underneath there. There was some clothing. This, they had a trap door underneath, and then they had this piece of wood that they can slide on top of it to make it look like, okay, there's no one there. And it had hinges to where you can lift it up like this and you can look straight down right on its trailer. And when you've seen it, you've seen a mattress lay there. No toilet. There was only a 5-gallon bucket. They were going to the bathroom in this bucket. But like I said, I don't know. That's how I found my trailer.
Okay, so ultimately, federal authorities found the teens. They were relocated. They were given to social services and legal advocates. But, I mean, this is the dilemma that you have, right? And so of those 1,500 kids, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, they just, my understanding is they just called. They didn't do any real follow-up. So it's not, they've lost track. These kids are not missing. Hopefully, the vast majority of them, hopefully all of them, are with relatives. It is not inconceivable that some of them have been trafficked. We just don't know. And certainly, the new policy by the Trump administration, separating children from their parents, is just, it's sick. It's sick. And as far as I can tell, I mean, maybe there's a, maybe someone else can point me to some other reporting. But in terms of what Jeff Sessions, in announcing his zero tolerance policy for the first time, illegal border crossers, 100% of anyone found to be crossing the border, whether it's the first or whether it's their first time ever, will be referred for criminal prosecution. If you are smuggling a child, then we will prosecute you, and that child may be separated from you as required by law.
Can I ask when these kids were rescued? Because that seems like something that would not be a priority under the current administration.
Oh, I suspect that was actually a year or two ago. That case started in 2014.
Yeah.
But the bottom line here is, and as far as I can tell, the reason why they're doing this is really simply we want to discourage people from coming up here with their families. I mean, I'm old enough to remember images of people trying to get across the wall in East Germany and being shot at. And I just don't remember anybody anywhere going, good, glad we shot them, we being the West, at the border. I don't remember anybody saying, like, why wouldn't they want to leave there? I mean, you got to ask yourself, why is it when people were trying to escape East Germany, we were encouraging of that? It was horrific, the idea. Can you imagine if someone got out of East Germany and our reaction was to split them up with their kids, split their kids up, send them back, don't tell them where their kids are going? It would have been absurd.
And the U.S. is much more culpable for a lot of these conditions that are causing people to migrate right now.
Yeah, we have much more ability to actually help. I mean, if we're really that concerned, the amount of money that we spend on sending ICE agents around the country. And now, there's one other element to this that is, I think, important to discuss. And that is that this is not 100% new. I don't even want to overstate it by saying that. A lot of people have made the point, and we've certainly discussed it on this show, that the immigration policies of Barack Obama, particularly in his first term, were also pretty horrific. There was a, they broke records for arresting and deporting immigrants. And it is true with, it is true that, the nature of the arrests were more focused on people who had committed crimes in this country rather than not. In some of those instances, though, the crimes are, you know, drunken disorderly or something like that. They're not necessarily violent crimes. And you have children split up from their parents. So we have had, you know, bad immigration policies really for an extended period of time. Certainly during the Obama administration, it got better towards the end. DACA was a big deal. Extended DACA, I think it was DAPA, right? Would have also been a big deal. There's a piece by Branko Markaček in the Jacobin that goes through this. And there was a report that was put out about the state of immigration under Obama. But, you know, we've heard from just from our friend Ronald Reagan, who's an immigration lawyer on the ground, that in practice, things are very different. And, you know, it's important to make this distinction. And I am of two minds about this because in this sort of ties into this other couple of pieces I wanted to talk about. I don't think it's a bad thing. I mean, the idea that people are conflating these missing 1,500 kids with the Trump administration's policy now of actively, like, determined first order, we're going to use the separation of children and parents as a deterrent to coming up into this country. The idea that people are conflating these two things and in doing so are being more aggressive about immigration policy, I'm sorry. I think it's a good thing. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and conflate these things for you. I'm going to try and clearly delineate them. And I don't know. If I had a bigger platform, I would probably do the exact same thing. But I'm also not going to sit here and bemoan the fact that more people are engaged in really looking at the implications of our immigration policies because they're making a category error. I've read that there's some concern that if you start asking for the Office of Refugee Resettlement to really get a sense of where these children are, you're going to create a Gestapo-like agency that's going to be on top of this. Frankly, I don't think there's the competence or the will or the money to do that. I don't think they're going to, like, we're going to be responsive to, I don't think the administration is worried about that, frankly. I don't see that as a huge fear. I think my theory about politics is you take it where you can get it. And if somebody is motivated to get involved in the immigration issue more because they see a tweet about 1,500 missing kids from the Department of Homeland Security, I mean, I think journalists should do better than that because it makes me question their journalism if they don't know the difference. But for your average, you know, Twitter warrior or someone who has just gotten activated, I'm all for it. And it's interesting because it sort of dovetails a little bit, you know, because there's like there are some people who, you know, I think it's important to that people are aware that this is immigration policy, that the problem is we have a failure of dealing with immigration writ large. It's not just a function of Trump, although I'm also not convinced that largely speaking, it's not just a function of Republicans. I got to be honest with you. I don't remember too much of the immigration reform bill that was up in 2004, I think it was, or five. And I don't remember too much about the one that was up, I guess, 5 years ago in 2013, maybe it was. Parts of it I know I didn't like. They had like a guest worker program, which I think is a little bit problematic in terms of of abuse. But if everybody gets into the system, you don't have situations like this where you have teenagers who are living underneath a trailer in a trailer park in their own feces so that they can work for near nothing in a chicken factory. You don't get stuff like this. Here is from GEO News. This is a year ago. I guess almost 2 years ago. 2016. And they were really ramped up. There's a lot of businesses that ramped up after Donald Trump got elected. If you were one of those people who were smart enough to go long in 2015 on things like for-profit universities or things like construction of penal institutions or detention centers for infants, then you did quite well in the stock market. GEO is one of these companies that makes detention centers, right? Was that what you call it, Brandon? Like detention centers, prisons, concentration camps, camps that concentrate people in one area. And in April, they rolled out their new specialized transport buses. Here you have it, folks. This is the latest in transport technology. It is 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, about 30 seats in one of those short shuttle buses, each one equipped with a new Graco high-quality booster seat. There it is, the car seats for all the kids there. The expansion created new demands to an already. So the expansion of the Karnes County Residential Center was completed in early December 2015. So look, this order was not just about Donald Trump. And increased the capacity to 1,158 beds. The expansion created new demands to an already unique transportation mission requiring larger capacity vehicles to provide off-site field trips. These field trips are part of the contract with the U.S. Immigration Customs Enforcement. Field trips are provided to all children ages 4 through 17 enrolled in educational programs provided by the John H. Wood Charter School. So we're going to get it in multiple different directions. There you go, folks. We're going to take field trips. Going to go to the San Antonio Zoo. There you go. And there. Oh, wow. Oh, look at that. Wow, I wonder what happened. What, will you take that right there? What happened right there? And there it is. In November 4th. Look at that. Boom. The Geo Group. It just goes up and up and up and up. There you go. Making America great again. You want to go? See if you go in there. You want to see something amazing, too? This is a little bit off topic. But put in EFT. What is it? ETF? Electronic Fund?
Electronic Frontier Foundation?
No, no. ETF. ETF. And put for-profit universities. This is going to blow your mind. See if you can get the, I mean, you could just, it. You know, all stocks went up, but not all stocks went up the day after the election. So this is what we're looking at. There is a debate out there. Maybe it's here a little bit too, but not so much here. But there's a debate out there about what people are calling a guy named like Jonathan Chait over at the New Yorker. He's calling the democracy movement in New York Magazine, the democracy movement. Some people refer to it as the resistance, although the resistance is a pretty blanket term. And there is some soul searching now from the center to the left as to why is it the left, and that being sort of the, and I don't know where to define this, but the sort of more Bernie sympathetic. I don't want to do it in these terms because it's just that that litigates something I don't want to litigate. But those people on the left of the Democratic Party, through, you know, DSA, those types are cynical about the resistance. And in Chait's reading of it, it is because they hate democracy.
As usual subtlety.
I was going to say, like, it's almost like it's just...
You know what the problem with Jonathan Chait is? Is it the same reason, many, among many, but this, he's actually, especially for such a centrist, he's pretty good at writing about the right, but he applies his same, like the same blunt instrument that you need to understand the right, he applies to the left, which is an inaccurate way of reading the left.
Right.
Not to mention, some research just came out that the people who actually hate democracy the most are the center and the far right.
His yes. I mean, despite the fact that there's a bit of a straw man here, his piece is Why Trump's Assault on Democracy Doesn't Bother the Radical Left. And he says the rise of Donald Trump has galvanized what could be called the democracy movement in the United States. Liberals now this is on the ground. There's not a big difference, but in the intellectual level, things looked very different. Liberals compose the right flank, and leftists or socialists the more progressive wing. In short period of time, Marxists and other radical ideas have gained a great deal of currency among the progressive intelligentsia, and their critique of the democracy movement shows how the very meaning of democracy is bitterly contested within the left. Well, first off, what I love is this notion of dubbing it the democracy movement. I hadn't heard that, right? I mean, that's like, this is a completely made up thing, and he's deciding to call that. And I would suggest that, you know, if it really is a democracy movement, and this is part of the reason why it, you know, this is, there is cynicism about this. If this is a democracy movement, then someone should tell Mark Warner. Then someone should tell Joe Manchin. Then someone should tell Chuck Schumer. Because they are cooperating far too much with this administration if we are still in the mode of, hey, we're going to lose our democracy here. That's a real problem. If you're going to argue that there is an existential threat to our democracy, you better be more concerned about the leadership of the Democratic Party that is not taking your warning seriously. The reason Trump concerns democracy scholars is that he violates norms or threatens to. A norm is simply a common practice as distinct from formal law or regulation. Before last year, FBI directors served 10-year terms, which served, and Trump switched them. While left-wing critics of the democracy movement have no sympathy for Trump, they do not share this analysis of the threat he poses. To begin with, these critics see the threat posed by Trump as his policy agenda, not any damage to the American system of government. Now, look, there's two different things here, and there's a little bit of sleight of hand. I'm quite sure that those of us who see Trump's policy agenda is highly problematic also see his incredible corruption as being highly problematic.
And that the two are synchronized.
Well,
that's where the argument starts.
That's where the argument
I understand that's where, but I don't see how you can see that.
And then he goes on to say, liberals see the Constitution as a flawed document that contained high ideals and have, in fits and starts over two centuries, come closer in alignment with reality. Leftists regard it as a bitter joke, barely worth the defense. Worthy of defense.
That's what we call partly it in true. Our Slack group. We're like, that bitter joke democracy.
Bitter joke.
Did you like that Limbaugh sound?
It's like a rubber chicken in document form.
And then he uses, and I think really misuses, Aziz Rana, who's been on the show twice in the past couple months.
Very interesting target for extreme acerbic non-rational thinking about democracy.
With it's an interesting honestly, one. He's one of the guests that we have. Like, look, we get a little bit dry, but he, you know, and his stuff was not dry. It's very interesting, but it was a pretty sober analysis, I would say. But he says, Rana, right after saying leftists regarded as a bitter joke, barely worth of defense. Look, I can't tell you how many centrists I know who think that there's deep-seated problems with the Constitution, not the least of which, you know, the number of representatives that we have, the way that the Senate works, the way the Supreme Court justices work. I mean, deeply, deeply feel it's deeply flawed.
From like a very operational and procedural viewpoint would reflect their centrist politics.
So very strange the way that that he's mutating. He's really, really working hard here. Rana dismisses defenses of, quote, Constitution and country, end quote, and the belief that, quote, the founding principles, end quote, contain, quote, a basic commitment to universal equality, end quote, as homilies that politicians had to repeat to be taken seriously by party gatekeepers and thus rise to prominence. In truth, Rana asserts, American capitalism is, and quotes, inherently oppressive. Now, if I'm reading his assessment of Rana here correctly, it is Rana thinks that people cite the Constitution rather cynically and that the founding principles and whatnot, to the extent that people cite them, were clearly hypocritical at the time, right? I mean, I think we can all agree that not everybody was created equal at the beginning of this country. I mean, even
I don't know what you could possibly be talking about.
Even if maybe you should be a little bit more respectful of norms.
And then he goes, having dismissed American democracy as a myth, left-wing critics seem to have missed some of the finer points of its continued functioning. Now, look, you got guys like Martin Gillens, who have written about that money drives our politics, that when there's any contested questions in Congress, that the side that is promoted by big money wins. I mean, these
and
are
then, I think the
uncontroversial.
Like since the 60s, right? There hasn't been a major policy dispute.
I don't know if it went back. I don't think he went back to the 60s, but it's been for at least decades. And I mean, this is poorly written, but it does.
It has a lot of term paper language in it. I remember, like,
a lot of
when,
big
you, when you're
jumps.
Writing and you're like, oh my God, how much more can I extend the word limit on this?
But
and
Eric.
You're like, they rather the.
Eric Levitz sort of works off of that piece and makes something interesting of it. In fact, I'm going to interview him for Ring of Fire this week. But he says that America's version of capitalism is incompatible with democracy. And this is America's version of capitalism. And he says, look, if you're going to argue that the problem with Trump is that he's breaking the norms, then when Chuck Schumer takes over as the leader of the Senate, you better want him to seat Donald Trump's justices. You better want him, right, to hold hearings forthwith for that next candidate, as opposed to saying, like, hey, remember what happened with Garland, right? Because if the idea is to reinstitute norms, if that is the ultimate objective here, that policy changes have nothing to do with it, that's what you better be prepared to sign on for. And if so, that's pretty pathetic. He writes that in Chait, in terms of the democracy movement, sees all the telltale signs of a bad case of norm erosion. Thus, to heal our republic and immunize it against future strains of the same virus, several liberal thinkers have called for the formation of bipartisan coalitions in defense of democratic norms and rule of law. In their view, the threat Trump poses is so grave and unique. Ideologues on both sides of the aisle should now prioritize maintaining rule-based order over winning policy battles so as to safeguard their freedom to settle such disputes democratically in the future. And he goes on to say, however, several social democratic and or democratic socialist thinkers see state and federal legislatures who routinely slash taxes on the wealthy and services for the poor in defiance of their constituent wishes. Regulatory agencies that serve as training grounds for the firms they're meant to police, a Supreme Court that's forever expanding the rights of corporations and restricting those of organized labor, a criminal justice system that won't prosecute bankers for laundering drug money, but will dole out life sentences to small-time crack dealers, a central bank that has the resources to bail out financial firms, but not the homeowners whom they exploit, a Pentagon that can wage a multi-trillion-dollar wars that exacerbate the very problems they were supposed to solve and still get rewarded with a higher budget, even as the housing department asks working poor to pay higher rent for worse accommodations, and seething beneath all those defects, disparities in the distribution of private wealth so vast and consequential, the nation's super rich have come to enjoy an average life expectancy 15 years longer than its poor. That's the point. Is Donald Trump something so unique, or is he a natural product of these policies that have disenfranchised so many people? Now, I happen to believe that the vast majority of Donald Trump's support is based in racial animus. And I do think that there is some reason to believe that some of those people are also relating, are also expressing their racial animus as a result of a general frustration and malaise they're feeling because their wages have been stagnant, or they're living in an area that's depressed, or they're not seeing any benefit. And it's just easier for them to find a target with, you know, the brown people or the libtards or whatever. That very well may be the case. But what is indisputable is that these are realities. And even if you want to take away as to whether or not you want to take away the efficacy of these as political issues, they are clearly problems in our society. That's undeniable. All of those litany of things that were just listed, those are undeniable facts that are taking place and are also very threatening to our democracy, because the way a democracy falls apart, right, is that things become such within the functioning of society that enough people are either turned to right-wing populism or are just feeling like nothing's ever going to change, so why should I show up to vote? You know, I mean, you talk about Wisconsin, you talk about Michigan. There was a lot of voter suppression, too, but there also should have been a lot more enthusiasm to come out and vote. But a lot of people just feel like this is not going to help me.
Which is fair.
I mean, look, without even judging it, you know, who cares if it's fair or not? If you can't get people out to the polls, that's not just the people's problem. It is the problem of the politicians. And that is the reality of it. You know, it's like we can't snap our fingers and make 100,000 people do something that we individually think is the right thing for them to do. The whole point of politics is to convince people that, A, something is the right thing to do, and then get them to do it. And
that's on you, right?
I mean, that's just right. The bottom line. Right. It's just like, I can't change the weather either. I can complain that it's raining, but I can't change the weather. People are as people are. And if they're disconnected from politics in such a way that they don't think it makes a difference whether or not Donald Trump is president, they don't think it makes a difference as whether or not he's telling the truth, then there's something else that is problematic. And if you get into politics, your job, number one, is to fix that. That's the point of being in politics. That's the point of going into government. And so the idea that somehow radical leftists or whatever, you know, whatever that means. I mean, because if, you know, you're referring to these people as radical leftists, then I'm not sure that you.
I guess I owe the Bernie-crats an apology, really, for making it easier to red bait the whole group of them.
I mean, it's well, I don't think he needed much.
I did like Aziz Rana's PhD dissertation. Democracy totally sucks, man. It's a lie, dude. I mean, she published for the Princeton Review.
And look, here's the bottom line. We are looking across in these special elections. We see these Democratic primaries, things like Medicare for All, Axios is reporting, was a big winner. Now, I guess we're going to find out in the general election if they carry the day or not. But there's no reason to believe that they won't. These are very popular policies. And it remains to be seen, frankly. And I haven't seen anybody prove that, you know, making it about like what Jennifer Palmieri called for a month after Donald Trump was elected. No ideology, no agenda, just about how horrible Trump is to various groups in America. Just, you know, is rude to, doesn't like. I mean, I think, frankly, you know, if you were to really dig into the perspective, let's say, for instance, in the African-American community, I think they would say, yes, Donald Trump is horrible, horrible racist. But we've had racists for a long time, and systemically, we have some problems that are bigger than Donald Trump. Donald Trump going away is not going to solve the racist problem. In fact, Donald Trump is there because, on some level, of the racist problem. And I think that cuts across all of it.
Yeah, I don't think there's that many mainstream politicians who don't have something racially problematic about them. You got to judge people. I mean, certainly there are degrees, but given the choice between like a Trump and, I don't know, a Bernie, who maybe doesn't reach out as effectively as he should or could, I think the choice is pretty clear.
Yeah, but I guess what I'm saying is that it's not even a function of an individual. It's a function of we have systemic problems. And
ironically, that's a whole other way of breaking down this debate. For all of Chait's talk about norms and procedure, it's all like, is just if your politics is just defined with your personal discomfort that this guy is president.
Well, it's not just personal. He would say it's like it's a threat to democracy.
I get it.
I think there is.
But at the same, another thing that I liked that Eric Levitz pointed out in that piece was he was like, you know what? Maybe when Robert Mueller is put in jail on terrorism charges, the calculus flips. And this procedure and democracy movement stuff being first and foremost, maybe then that runs to the head of the deck. But certainly I was going from him to the Jennifer Palmieri quote. I think those types of statements really just reflect a personal repulsion to him, which is fine, but they can't be systemic because they're almost like allergic to that type of analysis because everything's just the kind of signifier. Well,
you would have to believe, and listen, I certainly subscribe to the idea that James Comey, you know, but for that James Comey letter, Hillary Clinton probably wins. I would say maybe but for a certain amount of voter suppression, Hillary Clinton probably wins. Then I will go on with the litany of but-fors in terms of her campaign and whatnot. But you have to reckon with the idea, and we would have had to have reckoned with it even if she had won, you know, Michigan by 10,000 votes, Wisconsin by 5,000 votes, pulled out somewhere else, Pennsylvania, by 5,000 votes. You'd still have to reckon with, like, how did Donald Trump, this total scumbag who represents just about everything that we can say in a broad sense is bad about America
and humanity.
How did he?
I mean, really, and broad. Humanity,
but how did he get so close? Like, I think you would have to reckon with that. You'd have to say, like, we've got a problem here. We defeated cancer, but it could come back. You know, like, maybe we need to change the way that we eat. Maybe we need to go, you know, less red meat. Maybe we need to get more exercise. Whatever it is, like, you need to address those things. And I don't know. This is an argument you're going to see over the next couple of months because there's going to be an extended argument as to how Democrats should be running in these general elections. Once it's, you know, Once the primaries are over, then people are going to fight for what the issue sets are that the Democrats are going to run for. And if they take over the House, then people are going to fight for what those issue sets are. And this talk of norms and democracy movement, this is just no labels dressed up in a different way. When Chuck Schumer refuses to show up at the Senate, when we don't have Democrats defecting and agreeing on rolling back Dodd-Frank, this is what I would say to the Jonathan Chaits of the world. Get your own house in order. There are no radical leftists who are running in the leadership of the Senate. And so why aren't they as concerned about the threats to democracy that you seem to think that the radical left is not? Right? I mean, that's the real question here. Not whether or not you can bring aboard, you know, Aziz Rana from his powerful position. The question is, where's Chuck Schumer?
Chuck Schumer's like, yeah, I actually just read Aziz Rana, and my feeling is screw democracy.
Honestly.
Well,
where are the people on the, I mean, if you put this up as an ideological thing, where are the people, where's Joe Manchin? He doesn't love the Constitution?
No. Where's, by the way, I mean, what's his, I guess.
Well, Heidi Heitkamp, what is she doing? Is she going to, like, she's taking,
Why didn't every single job
ayahuasca and you know, going on a vision quest and, you know, talking
very,
about
very,
the
very interesting
thing. Like, what's going on here?
He's bending over backwards to avoid making the connection between our democracy being in trouble and capitalism and the shift to neoliberal capitalism in particular.
Well, you know, it's really
happened over the past decades.
Really ironic,
and like, it is ironic because the left, it's not that we don't care about democracy. We think the problem started before 2016 because it did. And if you want to talk about norms, this once again, this neoliberal system, it arose fairly recently. If we want to return to norms, talk about the New Deal, talk about like this is just regular progressive Democrat stuff. This is not even leftism.
I would say democracy totally lame. Is the new tag for my show. But I think that it's ironic, too, because people like Glenn Greenwald or Marcy Wheeler, they actually have a far better case to make that they are the minders of constitutional and procedural process when they focus on things like the NSA or the surveillance state. Like, if Jonathan Chait was so purely concerned about it, all of his recent columns should have been on making sure that Gina Haspel wasn't confirmed as head of the CIA. Yeah. Which dovetails exactly what you're saying about who to hold accountable in the Senate leadership.
All right, folks. We're going to head into the fun half. Just a reminder, this show exists because of our members. When you become a member of this program, you support the daily show. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you an hour or two of extra content every day. So head over to jointhemajorityreport.com. jointhemajorityreport.com. You can do a one-off donation if you want, or you can become a member by signing up to give a membership each month. And if you can't afford it, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. If you want the fun half and do not have the financial means to do it, we will not keep you from enjoying the fun half. Also, today is Tuesday, May 29th, Michael Brooks Show tonight, featuring...
I got to get this down. Marisha Bararadaran on federal job guarantee and postal banking, and Felix Biederman from Chapo Chap House. What?
Wow.
Funny guy.
What are you doing?
And that's tonight. You can sign up on iTunes or you can go to a YouTube channel. And also check out Jamie's podcast, The Antifada, patreon.com/TheAntifada.
Hell yeah.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920 is the number. See you in the fun half. No, 'cause you're all
she